My name is Eileen McIntyre. I'm a resident of Hingham, Massachusetts, and today I'm speaking with Vernon Dander, also a resident of Hingham. Born in 1934 in Stockton, California, Vern has had a multifaceted career all tied to public service, directly or indirectly. Vern retired from the military as a colonel in the Air Force after a 24-year career at age 45. He then began a second career, focused largely on work as a systems engineer, involved with the development of important warning and intelligence systems used by the military. Vern is married to the woman he fell in love with at Stockton College High School, and we'll begin our conversation at that earlier time of his life. Good morning, Colonel Dander.
Good morning.
So you grew up in Stockton, California in the 1950s. Could you tell me a little bit about your early family life?
Basically, I lived on what I call the wrong side of the tracks in Stockton, and we had the community was somewhat divided economically, but pretty nice childhood. I went to a grammar school on that side of town. The school system had a set up where they called a 6-4-4 plan, where they had junior high schools and then a senior high school where everybody got together. And the junior high school where I went was pretty competitive with the junior high school where my wife, ultimate wife, went. So I didn't meet her until we got to the senior high school. And that's where I met. Actually, I started dating her just before I went to the Naval Academy and exchanged letters. I was a little lonesome having gone from California to Maryland, having no friends on the East Coast. Started writing letters, and that correspondence was pretty intense for the 4 years. And after I got out of, graduated from academy, got through flight training, I ended up asking her to marry me, and she agreed. And we got married in 1957, and ended up pretty much staying together most of my career. She was usually with me, except for the tour in Vietnam. So yeah. That was one of the pluses. Little unusually for military life, having the family around you most of your career.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful to know about these long-lasting marriages that begin so early in life. But something else interested me about your early life in high school, you played team sports, in particular football, but also track and field. You went on to play football for the Naval Academy. And I'm just wondering, as you look back at that time, do you think that experiences on team sports through school were very helpful in terms of life skills?
Definitely. The whole team approach. It came particularly to focus when I was in Vietnam, where pretty much everything, if you were going to be successful, you pretty much had to do it as a team. And falling back on that team approach, it helped me tremendously. Also helped me pretty much when I first operational tour in Japan. We went to Japan, I was flying helicopters, small unit, about 10 pilots, maybe 40 or 50 enlisted people, maintenance, supply, etc. And instead of focusing, or typically when you're, especially when you're a young officer, you're trying to take on too much. And I learned fairly early on, especially because of the academy training, that you had to get the, I guess you call it, get the tools in the hands of the worker. And so I relied pretty heavily on my sergeants to essentially, I would try to give general guidance and let them implement it rather than try to tell them specifically what to do, which I found when I got a little further, older in the service, some of the younger officers tended to want to try to do that. And it worked some of the time, but lots of the time, especially I know in Japan, the officer that preceded me in one of the functions when I was the maintenance officer tended to hand out jobs early each morning, and then he would go off and fly. And then what would happen, things would change during the day. And I think some of the enlisted men took advantage of that. You know, they say, well, the lieutenant told me I'd do this. And when the sergeant said, well, you know, we need to have you do something different, he said, well, the lieutenant, you know. So they were using that as leverage. And I had a fortunate to have a sergeant over there that kind of sat me down right off the bat and said, sir, we've got to change how this thing operates. And I took his advice, and Sergeant Tindall was a big factor in the success of the unit. We had, when I first started that job as the maintenance officer, we had four helicopters and generally only had one in available in a given day. And it was 25% in commission rate. And after about 6 months, after I moved in and kind of took the sergeant's advice, we were running about 94% in commission rate, which meant we pretty much had all of them available most of the time. And I think that, that advice was well taken. I tried to follow that advice the rest of my career in terms of making sure that you didn't try to do it all yourself.
Yeah, empowering
team
members. Right. That's terrific learning. Certainly, I've come from a corporate background myself, and I would say that that works very well when people know that they need to use some judgment themselves. Stepping back again to that time, you talked about meeting your wife in, I guess, junior high school. You started to know her, but started dating her as a senior. So what was it that first interested you about this woman, Claire, as a teenager?
Very attractive. A go-getter. She had a sign on the wall that something about along the lines of today is speed and expediency. It was just, which I'm just kind of the opposite. I'm not that particularly well organized, but she was very well organized. Kind of interesting story there. When I was at the high school, I was doing pretty well academically, and at the time when I first got there, she was dating one of twins, and he was another football player. And of course, even though she was attractive, you do not encroach upon another teammate's turf. And so anyway, what happened was, I had heard that they had broken up, and I was tutoring the twins in math, and I had a hard time distinguishing which one was which. And I thought that the one who had not been dating her was the one I was talking to her, and I asked him whether he was okay he thought it was okay if his brother, if I dated Claire. And he said, "I don't really care." I knew my mistake. So anyway, I started dating her. That didn't get off. I was kind of a nerdy guy, even though I was athletic inclined. But anyway, took her on the first date, and we were going to a party. She had a Philco phonograph radio, which was the big deal at the time. And I went over to her house to pick it up. And to pick her up at the same time, and thinking that, well, it's protecting this instrument is probably one of the things that would get me in good and be a favorable light. I put it in the car, but I put it between the driver's seat and the passenger seat. And when I showed up at the party, other people were out there and saying, "He would what? You know, he didn't put that. Didn't put." In a position where she had to sit next to you, and she put it between you. So they said, you know, this guy doesn't really have his romantic act together. Anyway, that was one of the comments I got out of the people at the party. You did what?
So what was the overall social scene like for teenagers in Stockton in the early 1950s? And I ask you that because I saw the movie Back to the Future many years ago, which was set in about 1955, so a couple of years after you would have been starting to date Claire. Was that what life was like, or is that a caricature?
Somewhat. Actually, I'm trying to think of the movie that... it was a movie that had to do with Central California and the people riding around in cars and...
Is it American Graffiti?
American Graffiti. Yes. That was the movie. Anyway, that was more like what Stockton was about. Called Cruising the Drag. Take your car out and cruise up and down Main Street. That was, I guess, early Vietnam era, because some of the principals ended up, according to the movie, going to Vietnam. One of them, I guess, got killed. But it was a similar type of environment. That was kind of typical of the Central California. Unfortunately, every town, Stockton, Modesto, Sacramento, there was all towns down the center of the valley. Cruising the Drag was kind of And so that was, I guess, more characteristic of it. The town, Stockton was a very ethnically diverse town. And especially on part of town I lived, it was Edison High School, it was a junior high school. There was a group of fellows I remember who were in what they called the Key Club, which was sponsored by Kiwanis. And the Kiwanis, it wasn't just because you were academically good, it was athletic. You had some attribute, you were kind of considered one of the male leaders of the school. This is pretty much when it was male-oriented. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the picture, you'll find that there's only, of all the people in the picture, maybe 15 people in the picture, there's only three that are Caucasian. Uh-huh. And I was the WASP, White Anglo-Saxon Protestant. There was another guy that was the WIC, the White Anglo-Saxon Catholic. Another guy was the Jewish guy. Everybody else was either Korean, Chinese, Japanese, that. So it was very, in a sense, was very ethnically diverse. And I think that was, and some of those things have still carried on. I still have the class president of the senior high school was a fellow that was a black fellow who was, he was elected not based upon some ethnic orientation, based on I considered his qualifications. And we still exchange phone calls with him on occasions, like birthdays and things mm-hmm. like that. So we still have that affiliation. And that sort of carried on with a lot of the class. And unfortunately, I think some of those things now have somehow diverged from that. And it's sad to me seeing that kind of hostility that we're seeing now ethnically amongst different groups. I think it's somewhat oriented towards California. It was always, California was an admixture, and especially when I was growing up as a young child, this was during World War II rather, and we had a lot of immigration. Okies were coming in because of the Dust Bowl, mm-hmm. and they lived in the part of town that I lived in. Same thing, a lot of Hispanics. My best friend in all the way through high school was a Hispanic fellow. It wasn't unusual going down the street some nice evening in California, warm evening, walking down the street. You might be hearing somebody playing a guitar, singing Spanish song, and the next block there'd be somebody sawing away on a fiddle, doing something out of the Ozarks. I mean, it was interesting in that sense, and I think that somehow we lost something in the process. A lot of the people who are out there, of course, came out to work in the shipyards in California. It was mm-hmm. a big, the war effort was major, and so we had other people. I know some of my best friends were from Minnesota, and their family came out, lived in Stockton, across the street. We hung around together, and then when the war was over, they went back to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was kind of an interesting, I think very interesting time in the sense that there was, at least in the part of when I was growing up, the area I grew up, where there was pretty mobile, and I don't think there was so much hostility amongst people based upon their race or their religion, that type of thing.
That is very interesting to me because I grew up in New Jersey. My husband grew up in northern New Jersey. My husband grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. Mm-hmm. Our childhoods growing up in the 50s, very different from that. You had big community concerns as schools got integrated. And this was, Midwest and the North, not the South. There's certainly a lot of hostility that people had just because they weren't familiar
right.
with people who
right.
were different from
right.
themselves. And so what a great background that must have really helped you in the military and in your corporate career to have just had that early experience to people of all different
backgrounds. Yeah, well, especially the military, because the military, quite frankly, as far as I'm concerned, has taken the lead on the whole integration aspects. Mm-hmm. And you see that when you look at the faces now in any military unit, there's a Ed Mixer. And they're taking a lead, and because it's, of course, the federal government is the employer, so whatever federal policy is, that's the case. But I found that was the case. Sometimes I stuck my neck out in Japan as lieutenant, and I had this job as the maintenance officer, and go to work one morning, and I'm waiting there. The sergeant said there's these three policemen from the Japanese police force here. And I said, oh? And he said, what's your entry? He says, well, they want to talk to you. I said, okay, man. And one of them spoke English, very good English. And so I said, what's the issue? And she says, well, we have a Japanese woman who has been cohabitating with an American airman, and she has attempted to commit suicide, and she was unsuccessful. And they were concerned about who was going to pick up the hospital bill. Not that was the issue, see. So I said, can you come back this afternoon? I said, yes. And at that time, cohabitation was frowned upon. It was a court-martial offense in Japan. And so I went to the captain, and because I felt, okay, I didn't feel it was right to send court-martial this guy because of the situation. So I went to the captain, and I said, okay, he's the next one up, and I said, here's the situation. We have a squadron commander up in Tokyo area, and we were down on Kyushu, and I said, he's a redneck guy, and if he gets wind of this, we got a court-martial on our hands. I said, I'm willing to go to bat, work something out to get this taken care of. He says, have at it. So then I went to my sergeants. I says, okay, here's the story. We're going to have to set up a fund, and I'm going to start it out. And I think it was $15, which was not a small amount of money what I was making at the time. And I said, we'll put a basket up here, and we'll see. I think it was $150. I mean, it wasn't a huge amount of money by today's standards, but in those days it was. And the basket got full. And one of the reasons I did it was, I think, I had fellow officers who were also cohabitating, and I knew that the defense of the airmen would be, well, the officers are doing it, why can't I? So anyway, we got it taken care of. And I was always a little concerned about whether or not somebody might say something about that over the bar some evening about, Lieutenant Dander did this and is going to get back, because I would have been on the line for a court-martial at the same time, so I just kind of felt that was, it was a situation at the time, and it wasn't, that was one of the cases where I thought that having that background in Stockton sort of, I took that approach rather than just taking the line on the, here's what the regulations say, you best court-martial the kid, so. And it turned out, he advanced in the Air Force. Later on, you kind of track those situations, mm-hmm. and he advanced in the Air Force quite effectively. So I always felt good about that.
Yeah, as you should. A wonderful story. Let's talk a little bit about going back to when you first got your undergraduate degree from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1956. When you graduated, you were commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
When did you first become interested in flying?
Well, what happened was, I was recruited to play. The reason I went to the Naval Academy, I had no aspiration to be in the military. But I had a very successful year, my senior year in high school. I got recruited by what they call a bird dog or officer in the Navy. And they offered this, go to the academy. If you pass the physical, if you pass they had an exam you take. If you pass that, we can't guarantee you'll get an appointment. Because normally the appointments of the academy are made by a congressman or a president or something like that. And I really had not even attempted that route. I had other offers because I played football for University of California, University of Oregon, Stanford, other schools. But it was fairly apparent that if I did not play football or unsuccessful in making the team, that I'd lose whatever scholarship was involved. Naval Academy, obviously, I could have shown up at the Naval Academy and never set a foot on the turf. So I had, it was an advantage, essentially. I'd go out and try it and see if I wanted to play football, but I knew the education was there and it wasn't going to cost my parents an arm and a leg to essentially put me through it. And there was certain, glamour to go into the academy. After I got there, it didn't seem so glamorous, especially plebe year. But what happened was in 1947-48 era, before that was the Department of the Navy, Department of the Air Force, or Department of the Army. And then they created the Department of the Defense, and they created the Department of the Air Force as a separate service, basically taking on the assets of the old Army Air Corps. And at the time, there was no Air Force Academy. So they just had West Point and Annapolis were the two major service academies. And so what they did, in that era, going to the academy was the way you're going to be. It was presumed you were going to, future chiefs of naval operations, chiefs of staff of the Air Force were going to be academy grads. And that was kind of the story of things. And anyway, so the assumption was you had to be an academy grad if you wanted to be a higher ranking officer in the new U.S. Air Force. But they didn't have an academy, so what they did was they augmented West Point and Annapolis by 25% going in, and so when you graduated, 25% of the graduating class could opt to go in the Air Force. They didn't have to, but they could opt to go in the Air Force. And the Navy took me on three cruises during the 4 years of the academy. I went to Brazil, first cruise, very nice place to go. Halifax, second cruise, which was not that great, but we were hosted by the Royal Canadian Navy, which is a very fun group, party group. So we had a good time at Halifax. And then the third cruise, we went to Spain and went to England. So I got to go to Lisbon, got to go to London and to the capital of Spain?
Madrid.
I think it's Portugal's Lisbon. Anyway, so I got nice background. I got to go to the Prado, got to go to the different museums in London and that type of thing. But the whole time I was out at sea, which was the purpose for this training, it was when are we going to get into port? So I did not want to spend my life in a mode of when are we going to get into port. So the opportunity presented itself. I stood high enough in the class and had a number in terms of selection. It was sort of a number selection system, and where your class standing had something to do with whether or not you could, what your choice was. And so I ended up selecting the Air Force. I never regretted it. I get a hard time from some of my Naval Academy classmates who went in the Navy or Marine Corps about the choice, but it's one of those fun things we do every time we have a reunion. And anyway, from there I went to Tucson, Arizona, had a fun flying. It was called the Country Club of the Air Force, a little base down there called Marana. And went from there, went to Goodfellow Air Force Base in San Angelo, Texas, for basic training. Flew the T-34 and T-28, which were single-engine recip planes in Marana, and then flew the B-25, which was an old World War II twin-engine bomber that they used for the basic training at San Angelo. And at the time I got my wings, the Air Force had decided that they really didn't need as many pilots as they were producing. And typically in the previous classes, they might have 100, maybe 30 people in a class, 100 assignments to choose from. And so a pretty good selection. In my class, they decided that if you were already a regular officer, which I was, you essentially already had a 5-year commitment if you're a pilot. And if you signed on, if you were not a regular officer, which meant a 3-year commitment, which meant by the time you got through training, you really only had about a year to go. So a lot of guys were going that route with the idea that they get their wings from the Air Force and they go out and fly for the airlines. So anyway, they said, okay, if you want to get any additional training, you have to sign off for another 2 years. So make it a 5-year commitment. And of the 13, I think there were 17 people in our class fit that criteria, and they came down with 17 assignments. And of the 17, I think 7 were helicopter assignments. And I stood fairly high in the class if it would have been the 30 people, but amongst the 17, I was down in the 7. And so I ended up by default being going to helicopter training, which turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me. At the time, I really wanted to go out and fly a transport or something like that, but at the time I thought, turned out helicopters were a lot of fun. Helicopters at that time were sort of like a motorcycle that you were in 3 dimensions, whereas you weren't just tied to the ground, but you also could go vertical. And you could go about any place. You go any place motorcycle could go, you go with a helicopter, and probably places you couldn't go with a helicopter. So they were a lot of fun to fly, kind of the last of the seedier plants, barnstorming-style flying.
Right, you're smiling as you say that, but I'm aware that you, in your tour of duty in Vietnam, flew, I believe it was 196 combat rescue missions. This was hazardous duty. I know you were awarded a Bronze Star. I'm guessing it had something to do with that period in Vietnam. This could not have been fun. Although rewarding when you rescued someone,
The helicopter. I flew with an outfit called Jolly Green Giants. The story behind that is that before the wars in Vietnam started, they had helicopters were primarily used for troop transport. The Air Force had some what they call local base rescue, and they were sort of like airborne fire trucks. Unfortunately, they were a little late in the game for that principle because it was based upon the idea that when an airplane crashed, there was still something physically there, and if you could send a helicopter off the base, you could go out and fight the fire and rescue the people. With the advent of the faster aircraft, most of the time if you didn't parachute out of the aircraft disintegrated when it hit the ground. There was no way, you can't slow it down enough that it's going to stay. So anyway, what happened, they had these local base rescue units, and they did very short ranges because they were based upon just kind of 20, 30 miles from the base, and we were going, and in Vietnam we had to go great distances to get where we wanted to get somebody out. Anyway, what happened was when they first brought the helicopter in, it was a conversion of a Navy helicopter. It's called a Sea Knight, and what they did was they painted it up with the military green, black, and brown colors. And when they were bringing it in the first time for the training, one of the sergeants said, "Sir, that looks like the Jolly Green Giant." So that's what they adopted as their name. I got involved when I went. What happened was I got a master's degree. Spent some time at Hanscom Air Force Base and went out and was a helicopter test pilot in California. So I got back in the helicopter business, fortunately, and got some flying time in. And so I was picked up to go to Vietnam and get trained in the HH-3 helicopter, which is a twin-engine, about 20-person helicopter. It had theoretically had 3 weapons on it, but because of the weight limitations, the helicopter didn't have a lot of power, so we took off a lot of the, took some of the armament out and just had two 30-millimeter guns on it. Fortunately, there are a couple of things happened during that era that kind of changed the nature of rescue. In World War II and prior, in Korea, the radios were pretty big, and you basically almost impossible to carry one with you unless you were in a big aircraft. And so what happened was is they came up with the technology, which is now the basis for your cell phone, to come up with a survival radio. And the survival radio was about twice as big as a current cell phone. And so anyway, you could talk to the guy on the ground. So you could, and in particular in Vietnam, this was critical because you were in triple layer canopy jungle, and you could not see the guy generally on the ground. So he had to tell you, he could see you through the trees most of the time, and he could tell you where, how to get to him. So you know, they call reverse vector. So they would vector you over the top of him. Another thing that happened when Vietnam was that they ended up, because the typical rescue method prior to that was what they call a Stokes litter, which is kind of a steel cot that you put on a hoist and pull up, but it's about 6 foot wide and about or 6 foot long and about 2 feet wide, so you can put a guy in horizontally, and that doesn't work in the jungle. It's kind of hung up in the trees. So they came up with what they call a force penetrator, which was kind of a torpedo-shaped thing that had paddles on it. And the you put it down on the cable, it went through the trees, and then the guy sat on the paddles, you brought him back up. One of the differences, I was involved in some committee work with other countries, and one of the things I found when I was working with the other countries, like the British in particular, the British Rescue Service was sort of focused on not just military rescue, but on civilian rescue, which is basically the function of the Coast Guard in this country. So consequently, they normally would have somebody go down the hoist because they were dealing with somebody who didn't have any idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. When we were picking up primary Air Force pilots or Navy pilots, they were expected to know how this operates. So when the force penetrator went down, they were expected to know how to get on it, not have somebody go down and explain it to them. That was the second major thing. The third one, which was probably the biggest payoff, was the air refueling. And air refueling had always been around as far as fixed-wing airplanes for years. And one of the problems you had in Vietnam was that in order to get close to where pilots were being downed or anybody else were in trouble, you had to go to a forward base, which meant you had to establish some sort of secure area, and it was sometimes not so secure in a sense, providing, and all the logistics of having a lot of people protecting the site you're operating, that type of thing. And air refueling allowed us to essentially go up and theoretically be up as long as we wanted to. And like the first proof of concept was they flew a helicopter nonstop from the United States to England, air refueling it. And so anyway, that was one of the big breakthroughs. Another thing allowed us to get closer to the site because we didn't have to go back to get fuel. We basically had a tanker aircraft that was up there, and so we could be, you know, not be over the area that was where a lot of the hostility, where if especially was being an opposed rescue. We were allowed us to kind of sit back and say, okay, give us the best time to go in. Got a five minute window here. Let's get in, get them, get out, and we could be close enough to do that rather than take an hour to get where we had to get. So that was a big breakthrough there. So
it's interesting to hear you immediately go to the technology and system perspective of your experience in Vietnam, because after Vietnam, and you mentioned you had this electrical engineering master's degree, you worked on a variety of systems, both for military rescue helicopter work, as you're talking about, warning systems, intelligence systems. So it's interesting to see how your mind works. And I wonder if there's something that goes back early in your life. You talked about yourself, you used the term nerd when you talked about, you know, Claire's reaction to you as a teenager. Was there something about your life early on, I think, that may have given you this perspective of looking at things in a system? Because it certainly comes through here.
I always thought, I guess, I was logical. I like to think I was operating from some logical basis. I guess some people might have found that off-putting, you know, but I just, that was kind of the way I operated. You know, I was scientific oriented. Actually, before I went to the academy, I thought I was going to be a chemical engineer.
Interesting.
That was going to be the my life's work. And one of the advantages of being in the military, which when I talk to people about that as a career, is that actually you do have the opportunity, for most cases, to have a great deal of variety. One of the things I found in the military, which was one of the reasons I stayed in, was the fact that I worked for the same company for 24 years. Actually, if I want to count the academy, 28 years. But about every 3 years, I had a different job. And in some cases, some people, that was disturbing somehow, that, you know, that you moved around so much or you did different things. And even in the military, I had some people that felt that flying airplanes was it. I mean, you know, and being the best pilot in the world was what you should ascribe to be. And I always kind of felt, well, you know, flying was kind of fun. It was good for 3 years, and I enjoyed that, and I reminisce about it. I'm kind of proud I did it, but for instance, to getting the degree, after the 3 years in Japan, I got the degree, and the attempt was I didn't want to spend my whole life just driving an airplane around.
Yeah, there's a real theme in your background, I think, through your career, that's a continuous education.
Yeah.
You build on the foundation of your expertise, but then you're learning to apply your skills in new ways, you're stretching, you're learning additional things. And it's fascinating to see someone build a career in that way. I think probably people today could learn a lot from that, because you were flexible as a result of that.
Well, I think that, you know, what I've read, this is kind of going to be the way of life. I mean, I had, you know, said worked for the same company for, in effect, the federal for 24 years, had different work, different jobs. I think one what I've read is that, you know, this whole business of staying with one company throughout your life is no longer the way of a way of life, and people, I think, some cases people having trouble adapting to that particular set of circumstances. Of course, it obviously is a lot less stable. One of the things I guess I'm somewhat proud of in my military endeavors that I did raise a daughter who had at least I consider a fairly stable life for somebody that's in the military. I think my wife said we did 18 moves, but in the process she's pretty much, for instance, in high school, I went to Washington, to Pentagon. I knew that was a 4-year tour, so we bought a home in an area where I thought I could go across the river to Andrews Air Force Base on a following tour. So I at least had to be 7 years and maybe 8 years in one community. And we were successful in the sense that she ended up going through the same school district all the way through high school, from start of junior high school all the way through high school, which for most military kids was, you know, it was about every 2 years went someplace else. And it's not too bad, I think, when they're real young, but when they get older and they get their friends and et cetera set up, like in high school, we did have one departure in the fact that she, the last year I was, you know, I was at Andrews Air Force Base, and I had gone to go put in for another year, and a general called me in and said, you know, you've got to get out of Washington, you've been here 7 years, find something else to do. So I told my wife, and she says, well, we're going to stay here. you find a job. So I went up, came back to Hanscom, and I suppose up here for a bachelor for about 9 months while My wife and daughter stayed in Washington, and she finished up a high school senior.
So we only have a very short time, maybe 30 seconds left. What would you say if I asked your daughter, Catherine, I believe her name is? Is your daughter's name Catherine?
Yes.
If I asked her what she got from her dad that really she holds on to, what's one of the things that she might say?
I guess be flexible. I'm not too sure what she would say. I think maybe being flexible. She had to put up with Dad being away quite a bit. I mean, that was one of the things that very positive for my wife. She kind of pretty much was the one who raised her. But she's still, that's the reason we're here, is that we moved from Colorado, where I retired, and to be closer to her. And she got in, sent her to school in Simmons, in Boston, and she got entrenched in Boston, and when it came time to be closer together, we had to move this direction. She wasn't going to come to Colorado.
Yeah, so. Well, it's wonderful that you're able to be close to her, and I got to meet your wife briefly this morning. Real pleasure talking with you today, Vern, and I think there's some lessons from your life and your approach to your life.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about it.
Terrific. Thanks, and have a wonderful day.
Take care.